Live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, a federal lawsuit against Amy Helm alleges millions of dollars in self-dealing involving Levon Helm Studios. We'll talk with the Overlook editor-in-chief about the allegations, Amy Helm's response, and what the lawsuit could mean for the future of the Woodstock studio. A group of veteran writers and performers with roots in New York's downtown theater and performance art scene is bringing decades of experience and humor to the Delaware Valley Arts Alliance. We'll talk with them about their play readings, poetry, and live radio play this coming up this Saturday. Plus, country singer, songwriter, and radio host Laura Cantrell celebrating 20th anniversary of her album Humming by the Flowered Vine, and local news and economic perspective from our own James B. Huntington. After the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Linda Kenyon. The USS George Washington is heading to the Middle East to replace the USS Abraham Lincoln, which has been at sea for more than 8 months. The Lincoln has been at the center of concerns over mental health issues, as well as lack of fresh food and supplies. Reporter Steve Walsh with member station WHRO says the transition could still take some time.
USS George Washington is now on its way to relieve USS Lincoln with their 5,000 sailors. It's hard to pinpoint when the Washington will arrive. Normally, you would expect both carriers to remain in the region for a week or so, but a Navy official who wasn't authorized to speak publicly told me that there is no standard handoff period, so the Lincoln could leave rather quickly once USS Washington arrives in the region.
The U.S. Supreme Court has rebuffed President Trump for a second time, declining to hear his appeal of a $5 million verdict in favor of E. Jean Carroll. A jury had found Trump liable for sexually abusing and defaming the former magazine columnist. Opening statements are scheduled to begin in Las Vegas today in the trial of the man accused of playing a key role in the 1996 murder of rap artist Tupac Shakur. Steve Futterman reports.
Prosecutors will accuse Dwayne Davis, a former powerful gang leader, of orchestrating the killing. He will not be accused of pulling the trigger, but rather putting together all the elements that ended with Shakur being shot. The key evidence will be Davis's own words in interviews and in a 2019 memoir, where he says he supplied the gun used in the murder and was in the car that drove up alongside Shakur. The defense is expected to claim that Davis was fabricating and embellishing. Shakur's cousin, William Lassane, does not believe the explanation.
Of course, he's going to evade accountability by saying that he embellished for the last 15 years.
Davis now also claims he wasn't even in Las Vegas the night of the killing. For NPR News, I'm Steve Futterman in Las Vegas.
China's exports are booming despite tariffs from the U.S. and Europe, but the latest government numbers show the rest of the economy is sluggish.
Many economists say China needs its consumers to spend, but the bulk of them have their wealth in real estate. Real estate investment dropped 19% in the first 7 months of the year, and home prices remain down. Homeowners feel poorer and are more cautious about spending. Retail sales, which is a proxy for consumption, was stagnant last month, growing at just 0.6% year-on-year. It also didn't help that there were heavy rainfall and strong winds hitting large parts of China in July, forcing factories and ports to shut. Tens of thousands of people were evacuated from their homes. Another reason people hesitate to spend? Unemployment remains high at 5.2% in July. Jennifer Pak, NPR News, Beijing.
You're listening to NPR. Actress Hayden Panettiere, best known for her TV roles in the sci-fi series Heroes and later Nashville, has died. NPR's Dhwali Saikautau has this remembrance.
Panettiere was a former child star who began her career doing commercials. Her movie debut was as the voice of Dot in Pixar's A Bug's Life. At 10 years old, she worked alongside Denzel Washington in Remember the Titans as the sassy daughter of Washington's assistant coach.
What do you want?
Is Coach Yost here?
We're busy. Interviewing for head coaching jobs. Got 11 offers and certainly no time for you.
Her popularity grew with her TV roles in Heroes and Nashville, as well as the Scream franchise. Recently, she released a memoir titled This Is Me, A Reckoning. Her father called her an incredible light and a force of nature who brought immeasurable love and joy to all who knew her. Dhwali Saikautau, NPR News.
A child safety trial against Meta begins in federal court this week in California. The lawsuit accuses the social media giant of contributing to the youth mental health crisis by knowingly and deliberately designing features that get children addicted to its online platforms. It also claims that Meta routinely collects data on children under 13 without first getting their parents' consent. States are seeking extensive financial damages that could total more than $1 trillion. I'm Linda Kenyon, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Americans United for Separation of Church and State. Since 1946, AU has supported the First Amendment right of freedom of religion. More at AU.org. This is NPR.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. Levon Helm Studios is suing the late musician's daughter, Amy Helm, in federal court, alleging millions of dollars in damages from what the studio describes as self-dealing and improper expenditures. The lawsuit is the latest development in a long-running dispute over the Woodstock studio and the legacy of Levon Helm, including the future of the Midnight Ramble concerts. I spoke with Noah Eckstein, editor-in-chief of The Overlook, about the lawsuit and other stories across the Catskills.
Levon Helm Studios, the new management of Levon Helm Studios, has filed a federal lawsuit against musician Amy Helm, who is the daughter of the venue's founder, Levon Helm, and seven other defendants. The 62-page civil complaint brings 13 claims and alleges that Amy Helm used studio money for personal expenses and her personal music career, that she concealed transactions from other shareholders and infringed the studio's Midnight Ramble trademark. So they're claiming that at least $2 million in damages. Amy Helm categorically denies the allegations and describes the lawsuit as an effort to intimidate her, damage her reputation, and generate publicity.
And this isn't simply a financial dispute. The lawsuit also involves the Midnight Ramble name and trademark. Explain that part of the dispute and why that name is so important to both sides.
Yeah, the Midnight Rambles are inseparable from Levon Helm's musical legacy and from, you know, the identity of this iconic Woodstock venue. Levon Helm Studios registered the Midnight Ramble as a federal service mark, trademark, in 2011, and the lawsuit is alleging that Amy Helm later used, quote, the Helm family Midnight Ramble without authorization and tried unsuccessfully to register that name herself.
And you mentioned that the lawsuit is alleging roughly $400,000 in expenses charged to the studio with no apparent business purpose, including things like rent, insurance, personal tax payments, expenses associated with Amy Helm's music career. What else does the complaint say about those expenditures? And do we know how they, what evidence they have to support the allegations?
So their overall estimate of the damages, you know, they discuss several categories of expenses. They're talking about loans, compensation, operating losses, and allegedly lost business. You know, but the $2 million is a claim by the plaintiff. It's not a judgment or an independently, you know, established loss. Did Amy Helm steal money? We cannot say that. You know, this is a civil lawsuit, and our reporting doesn't identify any criminal charge. Right now, we've been going through the exhibits in the lawsuit, and we'll be planning a follow up. But I would urge, you know, listeners to go to our story and read the details, because there's 13 counts here, and each is very detailed.
And again, Amy Helm has strongly denied the allegations, calling them baseless and accusing the people behind the lawsuit of trying to generate publicity and make a cash grab. You've been reporting on this dispute for months, including the change in management and Amy Helm's response. What has changed with the filing of this federal lawsuit? Is this now a fundamentally different stage of the dispute?
Yeah, this is this is huge. I mean, this is the first time. You know, we started reporting this in May after the May 28th phone call, where there was a police. You know, the police were called, and Amy allegedly pushed the new manager of Levon Helm Studios, Brian Perillo. There, Brian, you know, had gotten a voting share given to him from Sandy Helm, who was Levon's widow. And in effect, that gave him 60% voting share of Levon Helm Studios, which put him as you know, the manager, the president of the C Corp. And this is the first time that we're seeing, you know, these allegations against Amy in a suit. So, you know, it's really a sad story. Levon Helm and the music that he made is so integral to the cultural fabric of Woodstock, and people feel so strongly about what his music means in the greater, you know, canon. So it's upsetting to know that this is what's going on. So we'll be following it, but you know, please, it's free to subscribe to our Friday morning newsletter and to check out our website. So we have been breaking news on this the entire time, and we'll continue to follow it as it incrementally moves through the court, and we'll see what happens.
While that's playing out, you're also following several other stories, including major questions about development and growth across the Catskills. I want to ask you about Xena Homes. It advanced through two Town of Ulster reviews. Tell us about this development and what the Planning Board and Zoning Board of Appeals have decided.
Yeah, so the Town of Ulster Planning Board last week issued a negative declaration under SEQR, the State Environmental Quality Review Act, for the proposed subdivision of Xena Homes, which is in both the towns of Ulster and Woodstock. You know, we're a Woodstock community news outlet, and we're covering this because the proposed entrance and egress to this 30 home subdivision would be in the town of Woodstock on East Woods Drive. So the Planning Board voted last week to determine that this extremely controversial project is unlikely to have significant adverse environmental impacts, which Woodstock Land Conservancy and the community organizing group Stop Xena Development categorically, you know, think otherwise. They think there would be huge adverse effect to the marshlands and the different migratory birds and amphibians that live in the Xena Woods where this would take place.
So now what does that mean for environmental review, and what are the major environmental concerns that opponents are still continuing to raise?
So it will have to go through a site plan review, and Woodstock Land Conservancy had challenged the town of Ulster's decision to have this play out in the planning board. Woodstock Land Conservancy wanted this to play out in the town board, but last week at the zoning board, they decided that it should be with the planning board. So that challenge was sort of tossed. You know, what Andy Mossy, who's the executive director of the Woodstock Land Conservancy, has told me is that because of recent changes to SEQR law, that they won't be able to appeal the negative declaration until site plan review is over.
That's the State Environmental Quality Review Act in New York, the SEQR law. Meanwhile, in Windham, the Mountain Club is seeking approval for a 26-room hotel. What's the debate over whether Windham actually needs additional hotel rooms, and why is the club proposing this now?
So our full-time staff reporter, Connor Greco, who we brought on in June, has been doing a great job, you know, expanding our coverage to Hunter and Windham. And he has been, you know, following this story as it progresses through Windham Planning Board. And what he's reporting is that the Planning Board appears likely to advance an amendment to the Mountain Club's already approved master plan, that they originally had a plan for 8 townhouses, but they're replacing it with this plan for a 26-room luxury hotel. Other hotels in Windham are opposing this. They wrote a letter to the Planning Board. They have concerns that the hotel would change a level of community character. But what the general manager of Wyndham Mountain Club, Kristen Leach, is saying is that this hotel would be appealing to a clientele that is not already going to Wyndham, so it wouldn't be taking away from their business, even though, you know, over the past year they are reporting these other Wyndham hotels that occupancy has been low. So they're questioning how this is a viable business. But in seeker review, that's not really a consideration. At least it's not a main consideration.
So beyond the economic question and this potential high-end market they're thinking that would be serving, what are the concerns about environmental issues or lighting, traffic, and the character of the surrounding neighborhood?
Yeah. You know, representatives of four area hotels argued in a July 28th letter that the proposal could harm Wyndham's community character. Connor had previously reported that some neighbors were worried that their view of the night sky and view of the mountain could potentially be disrupted by construction and a hotel. So there's concerns, but the planning board, you know, seems poised to get this through to the next stage for a site plan review.
And finally, a very different kind of Catskills story, but probably not that unusual. A bear and a cub in the area of Woodstock entered a home, and the homeowner's dog was injured, but is okay, I think. What happened?
Yeah, thankfully, Blue, the 8-year-old tiny dog that Susan Brown, an 80-year-old writer and editor who's lived in Woodstock, you know, for such a long time. The first time she came to Woodstock was 1967. But on August 9th, you know, she has sort of a sunroom that she keeps closed. And then she has the door usually on, you know, breezy days open into the living room. But the sunroom's always closed. But she hears barking in the living room. And a bear and her cub, who she's familiar with, they've been around the neighborhood for, you know, they're just a stone's throw away from the Woodstock hamlet of Bearsville. So, you know, being in the Catskills, where about a third of New York State's black bear population exists, it's not uncommon to see bears.
Yeah, I meant to say that it's not uncommon to have bears around. Maybe uncommon to have them come into your house, but they're around.
Yeah. Absolutely. So she hears Blue barking. The bear, she goes in, she sees the bear, the cub in her living room. The bear sort of swats or bites the dog. It's unclear. The dog has some flesh wounds, broke its foot, but is expected to make a full recovery. But she started cursing at the bear, and she said that once you start doing that, the bear really starts to move. So it seems like they understand English curse words. But so she thought she gets the bear out of the house, but she wound up trapping it in the kitchen by accident. At that point, she called the cops, and the cops came and got the bear out safely. But interestingly, you know, I love this story because everybody's okay, and it's a bit of narrative, but it also is, you know, we spoke to the DEC about what people can do. And also Susan told me that the DEC asked her if she wanted them to euthanize the mother, you know, the mother bear, which they sometimes do. The mother bear has three cubs, and at this stage in the cubs' lives, they could be self-sufficient is what the DEC said. But she said categorically, absolutely not. You know, that we live with bears, and this is their home as much as it is hers. So it wound up being, you know, just a story about how to stay safe when bears are out, and how to keep yourself safe and bear wise, but also how we can coexist, you know, in the woods with bears.
Yeah, I mean, it's a complicated relationship between residents and black bears, but nice to hear that she wanted to let those that family stay together, I suppose. But also, it is a good reminder of staying safe. Bear Wise is actually a national program developed by bear biologists to help communities reduce conflict between people and bears. Any other reminders that folks should take away from this incident about how they can prevent bears from getting near or inside the home?
Yeah, I mean, lock your garbage. So when I went over to Susan's house, I also met her neighbor who has young children. And, they're up early anyway with a 6-month-old at 4:30. But the garbage trucks come at 4:45. So they're going out at 4:44 to bring the garbage out. They're not leaving garbage out. Keep your doors locked. Do not put garbage outside. There was an instance where Susan had a tenant and they left some garbage out and the bear picked up on that. And it's difficult. We're going to monitor this because what the DEC told me is that once a bear makes a connection that they can find food in someone's home and they've gotten into the food, they most likely will come back. So the DEC gave her these motion activated sensors near her front door and back door. So if a bear goes by, a loud sound goes off and alerts the bear.
Which is actually called a critter getter.
A critter getter?
Yeah, the picture on the website is a close-up of it. It's critter getter, property of NYSDEC. But good to know that everybody's okay. And there's a picture of Blue there, too, looking a little forlorn under a couch, but all safe and good. All of this great reporting from The Overlook is at theoverlooknews.com. Community nonprofit journalism serving Hunter, Hurley, Olive, Socrates, Shandaken, Wyndham, and Woodstock. And we've been talking to Editor-in-Chief Noah Eckstein. Noah, thanks so much.
Thank you, Tim.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, local economic perspective from our own James B. Huntington. You're listening to Radio Chatskill.
Support comes from Garnet Health Medical Center, Catskills, with campuses in Harris and Calicoon, offering inpatient and outpatient services to Sullivan County and surrounding communities. Learn more at garnethealth.org.
We all know them, people who are really good at setting others at ease. What's their secret?
They listen well, they empathize, they reflect feelings, they seem to be able to pick up on something about you that many others don't.
How to cultivate the superpower of emotional intelligence? This week on Hidden Brain from NPR. Today at 2 on Radio Catskill.
This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On a Monday, we're checking in with James B. Huntington, our local economist and author, for some local economic perspective. James B., hello.
Good morning, Tim. Good morning, listeners.
Well, let's jump in with some stats you got, the latest on unemployment in the listening area. What you got?
This is for the month of June, the most recent one that's available. It may seem a little late, but it's quite favorable. Sullivan County, 3.6%. That's down 0.2% since the previous month. Orange, 4.0%, the same. Ulster County, 3.5% plus 0.1%. Wayne County, 3.6% minus 0.2%. And Pike County, 4.3% minus 0.3%. With a national unadjusted unemployment rate, as this is, of 4.4%, we did better in all five counties than before. What's more is I'm seeing improvement, especially in the two Pennsylvania counties, which have lagged behind and are doing just fine now. So it looks like the gap between those and the others is shrinking, and we're in good shape for jobs around here. At least that's what these numbers say.
That sounds like some good news for the folks out there. Let's talk a little bit more about the American economy as a whole and some lessons you found for that in Hong Kong. What's that? Did you go to Hong Kong?
Yes, I spent 9 days there. last month and into this month and discovered some things. It wasn't the first time I've been there, but it's noteworthy what I see when I start focusing on their jobs and the economy. And what is Hong Kong doing right? It seems like they're doing extremely well. It's really sort of New York City on steroids out there. It has more diversity and more strength in their economy and more shopping, and it seems to have New York beat in a remarkable number of ways. So why? Well, they have a high business emphasis, especially small business, which drives prosperity down to a lot of ordinary people, especially retail. When you see the stores are just packed there. They have goods all the way up to the ceiling, and they bring things down with those little grabbing devices and such. They all have so much stuff in there that they're prepared to sell really anything they reasonably can. It's duty-free with low taxes. That all also seems to mean prosperity. You have, even when rents are high, high volume can help. And they have so many people there. It's a lot of people are available to buy things, both tourists and locals. A strong pro-growth attitude that they've maintained over a long time. It keeps changing and growing and evolving, so things disappear and pop up. That's a lot of jobs for people who are involved in putting either in new buildings or remodeling or new storefronts or whatever you have. It seems like everyone there is putting out a maximum effort. They're very hardworking. They're always going for it. And everything seems super modern, so it doesn't pay, really. I mean, I thought of how their buildings seem to pop up like mushrooms, and ours here seem to take 5 years sometimes. There might be something there. If you are able to make that better, it could really help how the people are doing there. So Hong Kong is, despite controversies with the Chinese government, it is Chinese territory now, it is doing extremely well, and you can feel that in the air if you go there.
Yeah, well, even on vacation, you're always looking out at the economy and what's going on. They are the third-ranked global financial center with that massive...
Who's second? I know New York is number one. London, do you think London?
I think it's London. Yeah, I got to look it
okay,
up.
Okay, yeah, I know them, and London and New York are really the three biggest places for financial transactions, and that helps a great deal, too. It has a skyline that really, I think, beats New York's with over 50-story bank buildings. And if you have a bank, if you are a world-class bank, you have a presence in Hong Kong no matter what.
Well, let's look back over and see what's happening with the American work productivity now. What's been happening there with that measure of economic health?
Well, it's been gaining. It might be a little surprising, and it's not really due to AI. We don't know what's happening yet with AI. We have different views whether it's making Americans more productive or not, but we know productivity numbers are up sharply. It's a win-win for companies and workers. It's been going up. Let's see, what do I see by an index here? It's gone up from 115 to 125 in 3 years. So doing more with less is something companies have been able to do with fewer jobs in some areas, and that helps productivity. We have people who are among smaller workforces who are getting out as much work as a larger group was before. So that's the kind of thing that's going on with productivity now.
I want to jump ahead a little bit to housing and the problem with building enough houses. Besides high mortgage rates, what problem has there been with building enough houses in the country?
What may be overlooked here, according to this piece I have, is not enough people to work at them. We're short on construction workers of different kinds, especially people with skilled trades, your plumbers and carpenters and drywall specialists and such. And oftentimes there just aren't enough bodies there to get to build these houses. And a lot of them have been cut back by better opportunities in artificial intelligence, paying more where they're just vacuuming up electricians and carpenters especially. So it's harder to get them for building houses. So what we have here is raising construction costs, which makes it less favorable. It seems less favorable for people to buy them, and delaying projects. We have housing starts, but maybe not enough housing finishes in some area. So it's been as much as 400,000 jobs short nationwide for people to build these things. So they're going to need something like 700,000 new workers annually to cover demand and to cover people who are leaving or retiring or what have you.
Well, what two trades are in big demand these days?
No. They are electricians and carpenters, and they're because of AI.
Oh.
So we have, they pay a lot of money, and they require massive numbers. I mean, there's one data center project, believe it or not, a number of buildings in a certain area run by the same company. It can absorb hundreds of electricians working 10-hour days, 7 days a week. So the deal is, if you work there, you'll get loads of all the overtime you want, really. And it may not be the kind of thing you'll want to do for the rest of your working career, but it's an opportunity to make some real money. And then after that, you'll have an opportunity to relax or keep going and plan on retiring a lot earlier. These are the kind of things here. So we have the Detroit Electrical Industry Training Center. They have 850 apprentices there who have, in effect, on-the-job training, and especially with carpenters. And so many of these people are finding work, and there's opportunity really for even more if the data center thing keeps growing or even holds on the same.
Yeah. Well, they're not going out to build houses. They're out getting lured to build those data centers, it seems.
Mentioned retirement. Exactly.
You mentioned retirement. What are some ways to plan for your retirement if you've got that plan in place, but you're kind of keeping an eye out with the inflation numbers you see? What can you do?
Well, a few things that are basic, or you may be doing these things or you may not. First of all, to have the right investment mix. And that's sort of an investment disease people in their 60s often get, is they switch over from stocks to things that are more conservative. And over time, especially over the last couple of decades, the more aggressive the stock investments have done considerably better. So you should still, if you're close to 70 or if you're starting to retire, you should still, if you have a decent nest egg, be putting things in stocks instead of bonds or other things. Second, you have inflation-protected income streams. It's not necessarily going to go away. It's not, but for example, your retirement, if you take a later retirement age, if you can do it, you'll get a real big difference, 8% or more. Once you turn 70, if you're 68 or so. If you can handle waiting on it, you will get more money down the line. And if you have a pension with inflation protection, you may be able to increase it with more work. Look into it if you are in that situation. And three, consider part-time work, something that you can do, part-time jobs and gig work especially, that could help, especially if you're not finding enough things to do, if you're not sure what your life is going to be like. You may want to do that for a while just to bring in some money and do something with the time until you have other ideas down the road.
All right, let's get to the numbers and see how things are going very early this morning and how things have changed.
Over the past week, here are the changes and the results as of early this morning. Gold was at $43.93 an ounce. That's up 46. It was up $4,400 in the past week, but drifted back down. Silver, $65.34 the ounce. That's up $1.31. The ratio between silver and gold went down to 67 plus to 1, but it did better than gold this time. Dow Jones Industrial Average, 53,732, down 305. That's sort of a moderate, significant losing day, and that was the result for the week. A down week, but not hugely. NASDAQ, 26,729. That one was up 38, better, getting back to where it was. Oil, West Texas Intermediate, 82.23, the 42-gallon barrel. That was up 3.15, more tension in the Gulf. That's all that is. Bitcoin, 63,317, down 1,800 and some. Back to 5 weeks ago, back to the level it was at there. British pound, 1.3550, or up about a half cent. Still going up. Euro did almost as well at 1.1597, up 38 hundredths of a cent. Japanese 100 yen held, going right back to its old number of 63 cents for the 100 yen coin. Mostly a gaining week. The world outside the Gulf and Ukraine is going on, really doing very well, if it wasn't for those two sore spots and their follow-on effects, it would be very strong world times right now.
All right. It's James B. Huntington with some local economic perspective, local author and economist and world traveler. Thank you so much, James B. We'll talk to you next Monday.
Thank you, Tim. Thank you, listeners.
And get some news coming in from the Sullivan County government. The DMV system, the Department of Motor Vehicle System, has suffered an outage statewide. So in addition to Sullivan County, the state's DMV system is down. They're unable to process transactions at this time. We'll notify you if we hear that operations are back up and running. But in New York State, that DMV system out today. We'll take a break, and when we come back, when you've spent decades writing and performing, there's no shortage of material or reasons to laugh. Joel Greenhouse and Janet Noble join us next to talk about Too Stupid to Stop. It's a show coming up at the DVAA on Saturday. We'll hear from them next. This is Radio Chatskill.
This week on the Retro Cocktail Hour, singer Julie London, the exotic sounds of Martin Denny, and Something New by Tiki Joe's Ocean. I'm Daryl Brogdon. Join me where the music is always shaken, not stirred. The Retro Cocktail Hour.
Wednesday night at 7, here on Radio Catskill.
The brain is the organ that makes us who we are. It's our conduit between reality and thought. But somehow we've only scratched the surface in understanding how the brain actually works.
Are there things that we might not be able to think? Possible true scientific theories we might not be able to understand ever?
It's part one of our special exploration, Brain Waves. That's on the next On Point.
Monday morning at 11 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. a group of veteran writers and performers with deep roots in New York's downtown theater and performance arts scene are bringing their work together for a new Delaware Valley Arts Alliance production called Too Stupid to Stop. The show features play readings, poetry, and a live radio play with work that draws on decades of experience and, according to the description, more than two centuries of collective life experience. Joel Greenhouse and Janet Noble are among the local writers and performers taking part this Saturday. They're joining us now. Hi, welcome.
Hi.
Hello.
Joel, let me just ask you the idea behind Too Stupid to Stop. Tell us a little bit more about the show and where the idea for bringing this particular group of writers and performers came from.
Well, the idea for Too Stupid to Stop was a couple of years ago. I was having lunch with an old actress friend of mine. She was about 86, and she had to leave early to go to an open call. And we joked about it, and we said we'd write a comedy someday about actors who never give up and call it Too Stupid to Stop. So that's where the title came from. But I met other older writers from the area, and we're still working, and we decided to start a theater group, and we liked the title. So that's where it started.
You and other participants have roots in New York's downtown theater and performance art scene going back to the 1970s. How much of that downtown sensibility is still present in the work you're presenting now?
Certainly is. It's the only way I know how to work. There are plays, they're dark comedies. Some of them are dark comedies. One's Lost Souls on a Bus Ride to Hell. And then there's a sort of Baby Jane kind of piece about a grade Z movie actress and her demented daughter who live on the fringes of Hollywood. There's a live radio play with old school sound effects.
And
two actors playing all the parts. I mean, it's a big variety of different styles.
Janet, tell us about your work in the show and how it fits into the larger conversation among these writers.
Well,
I was going to ask Janet that question. Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, you're asking me?
Yeah.
I have three short plays. They're hardly plays. They're more like skits, really. They're very fast and hopefully funny. And then I have a longer piece called Disappearing Blues, and that is sort of a take on where we are today on many levels. It's about somebody who owns everything, mm-hmm. just absolutely everything, and moves as his whims tell him to move. And that too, I think, is, well, deep down funny. But anyway.
Well, Joel mentioned the title that everyone kind of likes, the title Too Stupid to Stop. What does the title mean to you? Is it primarily about persistence, aging, or absurdity, creativity, or something else?
Are you asking me or Joel?
I was asking you, Janet. Janet, what did you think?
Oh, you were asking me.
Yeah.
Oh, well, you know, this is interesting because I've been at my age now, which I'm thinking back about my life. And actually, I went to New York City in 62. I arrived there and I was lucky enough to have worked in the summer theater in Princeton, which was near where I lived. And all these guys were busy working here in the theater, and they sort of took me under their wing, and I did a lot of repertory with them. And so I was involved in the theater at a very early phase, and it was wonderful, just wonderful. But now I left the scene because I had to go to Hollywood and L.A. for a movie thing, and I just hated the scene so much that I came up to the woods and gave it all up, but I kept writing. Uh-huh. The thing is that I have a strange feeling that you are born a writer. You're not, you don't, You know, you don't pick it up as you go along. Mm-hmm. I just can't stop writing. Mm-hmm. That's all. I mean, I keep on, it's going in my head all the time. There's mm-hmm. always a script going.
Yeah. Joel, what do you think the group has to say to audiences today with this performance?
Well, you know, we're writers. We keep creating no matter what age we are. And it's just an opportunity to show off what we do. And it says, you know, keep on going. You can get out of bed and you do your art. You know,
yeah.
We know how to do it.
How has getting older changed the way you write and perform?
Well, writing not so much. I still work every day. I don't think the age has. Well, it's made me wiser. I have, you know, more experience. But I don't think the age has affected my writing at all.
I was just going to say, Joel, it's the one problem is playwrights, and playwriting is different from every other kind of writing. We need an audience. We love to have an audience. We write for an audience. In many ways, it's like writing music, dialogue is, and you just really want an audience. That's one of the reasons we're doing this. We've written this stuff. And now we want people to come and, you know, give us their opinion, or let us tell them a story.
What do you hope someone, the audience who hasn't perhaps seen a performance like this, takes away from the evening?
that they have some very interesting neighbors. Who write really weird stuff.
I love it.
Also, it's fun. It's fun. Yeah. We do it.
It's all very funny. I would say it's a very, everything is funny in it. And most of us have like big comedy backgrounds. Janet worked in the original Ridiculous Theater with Charles Ludlam. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I've done so much, worked in so many comedy groups, that I was part of a comedy team, mm-hmm. and done off-Broadway and off-Broadway and regional. You know, we just have so much experience.
And great stories, too, don't we?
Yeah, and great stories. And we want to share what we do. Yeah. You know, that's what it's all about. We're still here and we're still working.
That's Joel Greenhouse and Janet Noble. They're among the local writers and performers taking part this Saturday in Too Stupid to Stop at the Delaware Valley Arts Alliance. There's more information at DelawareValleyArtsAlliance.org. Thank you both for being here, and thank you for not stopping.
Thank you, Tim.
Thank you. Thank you.
Coming up, we're going to hear from Laura Cantrell about the 20th anniversary of her album Humming by the Flowered Vine, and why songs recorded two decades ago are still finding new audiences today. This is Radio Chatskill.
Unexpected absences are costly for employers. Now Startup is tackling the problem with an app that helps workers with transportation and childcare emergencies.
Having that app and having our employees make it to work has been crazy beneficial for us.
I'm Rob Schmitz, the app that's serving as a safety net. That story on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Listen to All Things Considered this afternoon at 4 on Radio Catskill.
Support comes from Catskill Art Space in Livingston Manor, offering exhibitions, performances, screenings, and more, with long-term installations from James Turrell and Saul LeWitt. Open year-round. CatskillArtSpace.org.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. Laura Cantrell has spent more than two decades exploring the traditions of country music through her songwriting, performing, and work in radio. Her 2005 album, Humming by the Flowered Vine, has developed a devoted following, and this year, Cantrell is marking its 20th anniversary with a newly re-released edition and tour. She'll be performing at the Rock Valley Schoolhouse on Sunday, the 23rd at 4, alongside longtime musical collaborators Mark Spencer and Jeremy Chatsky. Here's a little bit of Laura's Poor Ellen Smith.
Thank you.
Laura Cantrell joins us now. Laura, welcome.
Hey there.
Hi. Humming by the Flowered Vine, as we mentioned, came out 20 years ago. You're celebrating that anniversary with this newly remastered edition. When you listen to that record today, what do you hear that perhaps maybe you couldn't hear when you made it?
You know, it's an interesting question. I think that, you know, when you're in the heat of making an album, it can be a kind of a fraught process. And you're really sweating like different creative decisions. And for me at the time, this was the most produced album I'd ever made. My other records had really relied more on like home recording and were kind of more what we would sound like in a performance in a club. So it's really interesting going back now and hearing that while this record definitely has more sophisticated details, it also kind of fits it with my other music, I think, in a way that I thought, or with my earlier recordings at least, in a way that I thought it might stand out as something more, you know, like maybe a little slick or something. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when I go back now to listen, I just hear that we, you know, we're trying our best to make something really great.
What was happening in your life and career when you made Humming by the Flowered Vine, and what made that particular collection of songs feel like the right record at that moment?
Well, I had put out two records previously in the previous like 4 years, and I'd released them, you know, in a way that I thought would be pretty modest on independent labels, one in the UK and one in the US. But I'd had this really incredible experience, particularly in the UK, of really getting great attention for the kind of combination of my songs that I had sort of curated for the records that were by songwriters that I knew, my own songwriting, and then the few traditional or sort of more old-time kind of country stuff that we put together. So for this record, I wanted to keep all of that, but I also knew I wanted it to be all feel kind of elevated, and you know, thus that going it to the bigger studio, and you know, I think we had this feeling like we had a lot of ears that we weren't expecting with the first two records. So you know, there was maybe an opportunity to make a more of a statement, and that. You know, that's, it still sounds like I'm kind of swinging for that today when I hear it. But otherwise, you know, you're always like just trying to pick the best songs you've got, find the most complimentary material that goes with those songs. I'm not a very fast songwriter, so I never had a full record of my own material to choose from. So, you know, it's really having the songs by Dave Schramm available to me to record, you know, was such an honor to get to work with material like that. You know, that was sort of what was in our minds.
You've also spent a significant part of your career behind the microphone as a radio host, including work with Dark Horse Radio, exploring George Harrison's music. How has being a host on radio changed the way you think about your own music?
Well, I actually think the early days at WFMU, which I have, you know, I call myself now DJ Emeritus from WFMU because I haven't been a full-time on-air staff person there for a long time. But I did do a handful of fill-ins this year. You know, that experience of having to put together a program where I wanted people to hear my point of view about country music at the time, you know, this goes back to the early 90s. So, you know, there wasn't even a term Americana, you know, broadly used yet. But for my own experience as a fan of music, I was like, I want to turn people on to really great old country music, but also what's happening right now that is fully in the lineage of that music, and maybe builds on that lineage. And so I think that time, you know, developing that point of view as a radio host made me pretty comfortable with the idea of like pulling together music that could, you know, in a 10 song or 12 song format of an album, you know, also represent that point of view. Like it was something that was pretty familiar to me, I guess.
You're taking Humming by the Flower Vine back out on the road. You'll be at the Rock Valley Schoolhouse this Sunday, the 23rd. What's it like revisiting this album from 20 years ago and also with some longtime collaborators, Mark Spencer and Jeremy Chatsky? Is there a song that maybe surprised you in the live setting or on this tour, or something that's taken on a completely different life than it had on the original recording?
Well, a couple of things. When you reissue something, you get to sometimes add to, you know, what you've previously done. And so we had this unreleased track, Hammer and Nails. It's a beautiful song by Dave Schramm. And when we were listening to the, you know, to the mix of it, thinking maybe we should just go ahead and put this on, you know, as a bonus track on the new album, I was like, why didn't we put this on the album in the first place? It's pretty beautiful. Like, you know, what were we thinking and leaving it off? And so it's been fun to have that song join the rest of the material, because it was something I was really interested in at the time. But then because we left it off the record, we never played it in a live show. We didn't really, you know, I loved it, but I didn't, you know, really have a reason to promote it. And so it's been really cool to add that song in. And then I think, you know, I always thought that this the songs were a little more moody, and that, you know, in terms of putting on a live show, that could be a hard thing to figure out where you put all those moody songs in your set when you want people to go out into their evening like in an upbeat mood. And now I don't really care about that anymore, that kind of, you know, sort of self-consciousness. I'm like, let's be moody, you know, or let's just feel how gorgeous this feels to play this together. And certainly having Mark and Jeremy with me, as we've toured together a lot internationally, we've played, you know, across the U.S. together. And so it's just wonderful to still have those deep kind of relationships and be able to pull from them on stage.
That's Laura Cantrell. She'll be at the Rock Valley Schoolhouse on August 23rd at 4, performing the 2005 album Humming by the Flower and Vine, marking its 20th anniversary. There's more information at Rock Valley Schoolhouse on Instagram, and more information about Laura at lauracantrell.com. Laura, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Problem.
I see you walking up 14th Street, and you don't know that I'm walking right behind you, walking real slow. I don't wanna catch up with you, 'cause once we got started, we'd have to see it through. I see you on the street, you can't.
It's Laura Cantrell's 14th Street from Humming by the Flower and Vine. That's going to do it for this edition of Radio Chatskill. Reminder, download our new mobile app if you haven't already to take us anywhere you're traveling. It's available for Android and iOS iPhone devices. Go to wherever you get your apps. This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support comes from Sullivan 180, building healthy communities through people, places, and policy, one degree at a time. More information at sullivan180.org, and from listeners like you who donate at wjffradio.org.
I'm Stephen Dubner. On the next Freakonomics Radio, some of the biggest technology players are looking to move AI into space.
You have very different regulatory regimes. You don't need to take up anyone's land to put it up there.
In this new space race, who gets to make the rules?
Do we need a major disaster happening first until we see the need for something like this?
That's next time on Freakonomics Radio. Tuesday afternoon at 2 on Radio Catskill.
Today's forecast, mainly cloudy and humid with a thundershower possible this afternoon or early this evening. Today's high 78, humidity hanging around tonight with a low of 62. Tomorrow looks like it will be less humid, sunny, and a high near 80. On Point is coming up next. This is Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville, this is Radio Catskill. Local news, culture, and NPR.